Speaker is Paul Thomas, who will now give us some thoughts about all of these sort of things from the point of view of an artist. So over to you, Paul.
No, a bit short. Okay. Thanks everybody for coming. Just a little bit about myself. I've been working in the area of emerging technologies for a long time. I've always been interested in the effects on humans and how we explore emerging technologies. And then I'm also really interested in how they relate to art practice. So when a new technology necessarily comes online, how do artists deal with it? And what does it say about art? So this is going to be maybe a historical tour as well. So I'm not a historian. I'm not a physicist. I know hardly anything about science. But I would say that my paper or my talk is going to relate to Gerard's in the fact that we could then see it maybe the artist as the agent in this context. So this is my uncle. That's not true. See, you've got to accept that artists will lie to you all the time, where physicists try to tell you that this is probably the truth. So this is Faraday in 1842, and this is Turner in 1844. We mentioned the cloud. Turner paints the clouds, painting the Industrial Revolution. He paints technology at the beginning, and he produces a vision of it. Now, what your reason for showing Faraday is Faraday used to do demonstrations of magnetic forces. So the idea is that Turner, who knew Faraday, was impressed, let's say, by the power of magnetic forces on iron filings. And a lot of his paintings actually have that same kind of swirling patterns that were addressed in that kind of demonstration. So this relationship between forces within the world, mechanical forces happening, the properties being then becoming atmospheric, a part of that discourse. And then we have this really cool character. I mean, this is how we should all look. I mean, this guy, I mean, I think you'd believe every word that this guy said, because it just seems the epitome of knowledge. Anyway, he's a chemist, and I can't really pronounce French, but I would say it's Chevreul. Chevreul. Okay. Anyway, so Chevreul in 1855, Seurat in 1884. So the chemist that was really the basis of color theory, you've got Seurat, who's the first atomist artist, I would suggest. The first artist that gave you a look into the world as being atomic. You could all dispute that, of course, and say, that's completely wrong, Paul. And then this is a quote from a person writing sort of a reference to Cézanne. So in this quote from Cézanne, which is not Cézanne's words, but his interpretation, let's say, of Cézanne's discussion is, in order to paint the landscape correctly, first I have to, imagining the geographic strata, imagine that the history of the world dates from the day when two atoms collide, when two whirling eddies, two chemical dances combined, these great rainbows, these cosmic prisons, the dawn of man over the void. I see the things rising, I'm reading Lucretius, I saturate myself by them. Which Lucretius, who suggested that the fall of atoms in a void, unpredictably swerve, which is the Kliniman, and in unpredictably swerving, they create matter, nature, and the rest of you. So Cézanne, who reconstructed our understanding of, let's say, landscape, was aware of atomic forces, who was aware of concepts. Now, maybe he wasn't 100% aware, but maybe he was. of what was actually going on. So then I'm jumping you to 1914, and this really fantastic work by Marcel Duchamp, The Three Standard Stoppages, where he drops a piece of string. Sorry, in the slide, the projection in this room is really bad, so people at the back can't see the bottom of the slides. It's no tilted floor or anything, so I apologize for this. But there's just, what he did was he dropped a piece of string three times, and each one creates a kind of wave on the black canvas, and then he traces that out and forms these three templates, which are three measurements. So he's got three different measurements out of the... So this is relative to what happens next, and I'm jumping that along, but this is a quote by Karen Barad, just talking about the fact that the way we measure the world interferes with the measurement, what's being measured, how we measure. And Barad talks about that in the way that it's like turning up a light to see how dark a room is. It just can't be done. So here's the person you've already seen, Heisenberg. So in 1927, Heisenberg presents his uncertainty principle. Now this, of course, is around a time when everybody's maybe talking about this, or other scientists are exploring this. But how does artists deal with this? How do artists deal with the uncertainty principle? So when you're faced with an inability to comprehend what's going on as an artist, maybe there's a way of creating a new visual language. So this is what's being said here. And so this is a painting by Roberta Matta in 1944 that suggested that is actually a visualization of the atomic quantum world. And here's a couple of close-ups taken with my iPhone. So the vibration is not, that's just me shaking as I take the photograph. It's not part of the painting. But you can see from these close-ups, there's a potential to visualize a world that's never been seen before, couldn't be comprehended. It's like the Surrealist painting, Psychological Trauma. And if you look at the spin of the electrons that we'll see in a minute, this sort of arrow coming through even seems to suggest this spin. And this is 1944. So a question that I've been asking is, what takes place when you observe an artwork that appears to naturally summarize what you actually see in the world? You ask a question, what would the world be like if this artwork was going to truly predict what you could see as being the world? Now, Heisenberg did his theory in 1927, and then in 35, I think it was, Podolsky and Rosen said that this was all wrong, and it was a really rubbish theory. And so there was this argument between whether quantum was really true or not true. And in 1964, John Bell came up with Bell's theorem, which roughly suggested that the sort of question was that he would do the experiment to capture reality in the act of happening. And in capturing reality, he would prove or disprove the theory. And so this is Bell's theorem. So as the artist and agent, I would suggest that what Giacometti was doing in 1949, predating the 65, was trying to capture in his marks as an agent, viewing the world in relationship to Gerard's talk, seeing, making marks, questioning, and then remaking marks on the interpretation of not being able to do it. I mean, when you make a mark on a piece of paper, you put one mark down, and you draw the distance between you and the object, you're making an assumption, a probable mark that this is the distance. You then put the second mark down, which questions the first mark. In other words, it questions the existence of the first mark. Is this in the right place? Is it the right tone? Is it where it should be? The second mark then creates that problem. The third mark then says, is the second and first mark in the right place? Now, what's the likelihood of you getting any one of those marks right? About zero. So therefore, the probability grows. And every time an artist looks at the world, those probabilities increase. Not by an experiment, but by the experiment of looking. Not by a mechanistic experiment, but by the experiment of seeing. So I would suggest that Giacometti, and we could look at other artists, this is just maybe, but in relationship to measurement, questions measurement. Like the three standard stoppages questioned by Duchamp, questioned Heisenberg's 10 years before Heisenberg actually did it, the work. So now I'm trying to move on quite quickly. In 82, the same time that Alain Espert and his colleagues demonstrated that quantum mechanics through creating the experiment to prove Bell's theorem, proved that Bell's theorem was correct and that nothing compatible with quantum, with the classical world, could be done in the quantum world. Feynman produces the paper to create the basis for all quantum computing. In other words, he suggests that we can use atoms as part of the computer. So in this, and I've given two clips from his paper, but the one that I like is at the bottom where he gets a little bit excited about this and suggests that nature isn't classical, that it's quantum. And this notion then that what we actually exist in is a quantum world and that nature is quantum and that we have to start to be aware of how this works. This is a work in 2002 by Victoria Vesna and James Jimczewski, where the people's shadows are pushing what is called a quantum buckyball. Oh, it's not a quantum, it's a buckyball, which is made out of, which is a creation. And what they're doing is they're actually, with their shadows, manipulating the atomic world. They're manipulating and moving the quantum world around. And because of the shadows and the distance, they're helping each other manipulate the quantum world. Now, I've put that in just because there are the relationship then is between the fact that artists are now still trying to comprehend how we engage in the quantum world. And this is some of the images from Andreas and his team's work, well, not this image, but maybe the other images that are going to come up, about the spin of the electron. And the reason that we're talking about this, from my perspective, is that if, as Jared pointed out, that we're going to have intelligent computers and the computers are going to be dealing with atoms, and these atoms are the same atoms that you have in your brain now that you're using, then the same relationship that you have with the material world is actually going to be in the computers. So you, this is a silicon and phosphorus, where a phosphorus atom is locked in silicon, and it feels strange to talk about this in front of the people that are doing it from as an artist as opposed to being a physicist who's doing it. But so if I get it wrong, they can tell me in question time that I've got it wrong. A hit where the series of microwaves affect the electron that's captured inside the silicon in a frozen state between north and south. The microwave affects it and then spins it. And it spins it to a superposition because in a quantum context, it's in all places at once. And they use this to get a probability data that will enable them to roughly work out where they believe that position should be. So this is a then the microwave signal hitting the electron, turning it to spin, which would then spin in various ways, which would then enable a series of data to come up, which is your classical zeros and ones, which would then be, to some extent, the increased processing power that is given you by using the quantum computer. Okay, I know that doesn't really explain the complexity of it, but this is a piece of work that I've developed directly from the data that they sent. So if you imagine this is, each one of these is a microwave signal, and every time it blips, it's when it's affected the electron. So this then is a meter by 2 meters. And you start to see this sort of river of patterns. But if you started to think of Lucretius's atoms falling in the void, independently swerve, you start to get a visual metaphor in relationship to a sort of ancient philosophy, which is this work starts to become indexical to that kind of potential fabric of the universe type of concept. So this is something that I've been trying to work on, and this is something that in researching where we start to see that the clinamen, which is the independent swerve of the atoms which we mentioned, happens at a speed beyond thought. So it has to happen faster than thinking. The reason it has to happen faster than thinking is it's like intuition. Does intuition happen at a slow speed, or does it happen at a flash that we can't understand? And in a, Deleuze talks about it as infinite speed. So a speed that we can't comprehend, it happens at that speed. So the question that I would ask in relationship to the questions that Jared would ask is that parallel intuition, and could the quantum computer be intuitive? So could it develop intuition because it would happen at that speed, faster than what the way that we can... I mean, our thoughts are really quite slow and they all get blocked up. And they all fight for supremacy in our heads. But Joel will be able to tell me if that's true or not. So these are the probability waves. So this is, again, trying to interpret what's actually happening and starting to build models to start to think of how these waves work and the difference between a particle and a wave formation. And this is a reinterpretation of the sound of the data that you saw streaming down, turned into an audio signal, and then tried to remix it to give it a kind of less scientific, but maybe a more atmospheric kind of sound. Because what I'm trying to do now is create a work that puts you inside the thinking of the quantum computer. So I want to try and get some use to sort of experience what it is that's actually happening. So this quote by Sears is always, I've always loved this, that atoms are not souls, the soul itself is atomic. So if there's no such thing as nothing, if everything is something, then everything is atomic, then the soul has to be atomic. So it's a logical sort of formation. Whether this is true or not is the interesting. And what Max Tegmark says is that it's, I conjecture the consciousness can be understood as yet another state of matter. Just as there are types of liquids, there are many types of consciousness. Now, these, and I know that I'm rambling all over the place, but what I'm doing, trying to do is tie it together, that artists have worked parallel with what's happening in science for a long time. They've actually understood it maybe predates the physicists in trying to bring the world into existence, to try and understand how we see the world and re-communicate it back. And we need now more artists to be exploring what's happening at the cutting edge of physics, because it's shifting our understanding of the world. And as humans, we can't comprehend it. And as Jared pointed out, physicists can't comprehend it. But I would think that in 1944, Roberto Matta kind of comprehended something that was going on and gave us a visual image of it. And just to finish, so this is what I'm imagining, the sonification of data that from Andreas's computer. And what I really want to do, which I'm hoping Andreas will let me, is to use Feynman's paper as an audio to read it, and to read it to the electron in the quantum computer. So the concept that developed the quantum computer to be read to the computer to create the spin that then becomes the data. So that's what I'm... Because it would be great to have that kind of input. Anyway, this is the work, and this is the end of the talk. Okay.
Thanks very much, Paul. And